WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The Film Forum in New York is about to begin a 25th anniversary retrospective of the films of Albert and David Maisels, two pioneers of documentary filmmaking. The French have called their style cinema verite, but the Maisels have used the less pretentious description of direct cinema. Albert Maisels is joining us from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. He has said, "The essential thing about our films is not making believe, but finding out. Rather than beginning a documentary with a predetermined idea of what they're looking for and then making sure they find it, the Maisels' approach is to get to the scene with the film equipment and let the story unfold in its own way. They use no sets, scripts, or narration." Their films include Gimme Shelter, which recorded the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont, where a fan was murdered; Grey Gardens, which is an inside look at the life of Jacqueline Kennedy's eccentric aunt and cousin; and What's Happening, an account of the Beatles' first week in America during their 1964 tour. The Maisels just won two Emmys for the PBS program Vladimir Horowitz, The Last Romantic. A new film, Horowitz Plays Mozart, will premiere at the New York Film Festival. Most of these films were funded from profits from the Maisels' commercials and industrial films. You may have seen some of their documentary-style commercials for Polaroid, American Express, ABC News, and Citibank. David Maisels died in January, and Albert Maisels continues to run the studio. Albert Maisels, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
Let's talk about the days in the early 60s when you first started to make documentaries. What were some of the conventions of the documentary form when you started out?
Oh, well, it was a form that didn't and couldn't seem to stand on its own. For one thing, there was no sync sound of a portable nature. If you wanted to get sync sound, you had to plug the big tripod stabilized camera into the wall and get the electricity from the wall rather than from batteries. And all that changed in 1960 when several friends of mine and myself got some money from Life magazine and extended the Life magazine approach of a photographer and a reporter into movie making. The photographer I was one of the photographers, and I had, and along with me was a sound man, and that was the whole crew. And in two or three of our major films, my brother and I, who later began our own company, actually in 1962, 25 years ago, that was the crew for Grey Gardens, for Salesman, and it was the ideal way for us to operate it. And it meant that we could tell stories as they were happening rather than have to rely on narration, music, artificial devices that came in afterwards as a way of rescuing something that you just didn't get on its own.
And you wanted your presence as filmmakers to disrupt the action around you as little as possible.
Right, right. Because we believed in getting the story itself. That was the revolution in journalism that Life magazine had started. Nobody was going to tell anybody what to do when a photograph was being taken. And we weren't about to tell anybody what to say or to do in filming them. It's an idea that actually was long overdue. It couldn't come about until the technology existed for it, as it was developed in 1960. But I know a good friend of mine, Ricky Leacock, who began the sort of work with me and Don Pennybaker in 1960, when we made a film of the primary election campaign between Kennedy and Humphrey, with Bob Drew also, who was our contact with Life magazine. I remember Ricky said, in 1907, two French cameramen went to Moscow, and they visited Tolstoy to see if they could film him with a camera, of course, that was just a wind-up movie camera. And Tolstoy agreed to it, and he's all excited about it. He said, now it's no longer necessary for anybody to concoct a story, that you could actually go out with a movie camera and film ordinary Russian life. Well, that was the seed of the whole new method of making documentaries that didn't take place until 1960.
Now, you have been the cameraman,
right,
for the movies that you've made.
Yeah, but
made.
It's along with this whole new way of making films, there was a breakdown of things away from categories of roles that people took. And people who were called editors before took a far greater role in constructing the film than an editor would in a regular sort of movie. The cameraman was no longer a guy that got directions from a director. In fact, the photography in the Hollywood films is still really done by a cameraman who follows the orders of a lighting guy and so forth. But, so that it meant a whole new set of relationships between the people who were working and the people that you were filming.
Yeah, less hierarchical and less strictly defined.
Right.
Nevertheless,
which has a big influence on the kind of spirit that goes into making one of our films. Everybody in the film has something that to contribute, and if it's a little bit out of what he normally does, that's accepted too.
But nevertheless, you were the one who had to lug around the camera.
Right. 25 pounds of it.
Yeah, did you do anything to customize your camera to make it more portable back in the early days when you were starting?
Yes. Well, I redesigned the whole thing so that it didn't need a tripod. It could rest on my shoulders in full balance without even having to support it with either hand. I had it low enough down so that both eyes could look over the camera and see not only what through the camera but also outside of the camera so that I was suddenly a human being rather than just a technical device recording something. And I put an exposure meter at the end of the lens of the camera and so that I didn't have to put the camera down in order to change the aperture as it might change if the light conditions were changing. It put everything at the service of the film and not at the service of the technology or prejudices for example, I mean, until we began making these films, you couldn't get anything in the movie theater or on television unless it was shot in 35 millimeter. So we made terrific efforts to make the 16 millimeter equipment and processing and all of such a good quality that you couldn't tell it the difference between that and 35. And so that made for a terrific effort. And not that we cared much whether it was 16 and 35, except that the 35 meant big, big equipment that, again, would require dollies and all that paraphernalia that gets in the way of mobility and also makes anything to do look like a Hollywood production,
right,
which interferes with the relationship that you have with the people that you're filming.
Albert Maysles is my guest, and the Film Forum in New York is about to begin a 25th anniversary retrospective of the films of Albert and his late brother David Maysles. As part of this retrospective, they're showing a 1964 movie that you made called What's Happening, the Beatles in the USA.
Right.
And it's your documentary film about the Beatles' first few days on their first tour of the United States. And it's really an amazing film. I had no idea this film existed. I think very few people actually did. And it's remarkable. You were in the limousine with the Beatles as they were driving around Manhattan to their hotel. You're in their hotel room. You're in all the places the press couldn't get to. How did you get there?
Well, it may be an interesting story just to relate to you how we got to meet the Beatles and film them. We were in our studio one day, and I answered the phone when someone from Granada Television in England was calling us to say that the Beatles were on their way to America. In fact, they were 3 hours outside, out of Idlewild, as it was then called, which is, of course, is JFK. And the gentleman in the other end of the line, I'm mentioning the name Beatles. I held my hand over the phone, and I turned to my brother, and I asked him who they were. Are they any good? And my brother nodded his head as if to say, then they are good, and we should be interested. And anyway, we made our deal on the phone, and since we always have our own equipment, we rushed off to the airport just as the plane was a little pin spot in the sky. We spent the next 3 days with them. And then another three on their trip to Washington and Miami. So there we were with, fortunately at a time in 1964, when the technology and experience that we had been developing for the last 4 years had reached a point where we could come up with something, you know, quite revolutionary. And when the film showed in England that next week, it was greeted as a revolutionary thing in making films. And then, of course, we wanted to get the film shown on in the movie theaters. And, well, we didn't have a release for that, and the Beatles were about to do A Hard Day's Night, which they made maybe six or 8 months later. And Richard Lester saw our film and he used a handheld camera to sort of simulate what we were doing, using a handheld camera, filming the Beatles for real, which I think is quite a different thing. And it was quite interesting at that time what they did as was ours. And I think it was not long after that that I don't watch television, but you would know better than I. The Monkees, you remember that television show?
Oh, sure,
show?
Yeah, sure.
Using a handheld camera again, but with scripts and so forth. They simulated that style. But I've never been interested in handheld cameras as such, only in as much as it could bring me that much closer to events and people and not interfere with what was going on.
Sure, but the style started to stand for something.
Yes, yes.
Did you get mobbed by the fans when you were trying to shoot the Beatles?
Well, a lot of the film we did was just with them in their hotel rooms, coming back from the airport in the limousine that they got. When they got to the airport, actually nobody knew at that time whether there'd be anyone at the airport to greet them. 5,000 kids showed up, and then Murray the K, who thought of them as really nothing, it took him a day of seeing what was going on to realize that they really were this incredible phenomenon. And then he jumped on the bandwagon and he became part of Beatlemania himself.
Sure, he became known as the fifth Beatle. And,
right.
And for anyone who doesn't know him, Murray the K was one of the top New York rock and roll disc jockeys at the time. As a matter of fact, I'd like to play a clip from your movie about the Beatles.
Sure.
In which Murray the K goes into the Beatles' hotel room and is doing this kind of interview with them for WINS, the station that he was a disc jockey on in New York. So here's the clip from the Maisel's movie about the Beatles.
We're having a ball. I already saw the dress rehearsal of the TV show, and
yeah.
It's going to be a gas. So there'll be some things for these boys to have. We got the Meet the Beatles documentary coming up at 7 o'clock, which is in about 44 minutes from now. And how do you like the working over there, Ed Sullivan's show?
It's great. We're having a great time. Ed's a great fella. But play some swinging records, will you? None of that drag stuff.
He doesn't want any of that soft stuff. He wants the beat.
This is jockey Murray the K with the Beatles in their hotel room in 1964 from the Maisel's movie that's about to be shown for the first time since 1964.
Well, it's never been shown as a film, so this is the first time that it'll be ever shown on the screen.
The real question to me about the movie is, how come it hasn't been shown anyplace except on television in 1964.
Oh, well, we contracted to make the film for a British television. And in England, you don't need a release at all for anything you might do of documentary nature. In this country, you do. And so we didn't need a release and didn't ask for it at that time. But then after we made the film, we asked for the release, but then they were about to... They'd already made a contract with United Artists for their Hard Day's Night, and those people didn't want everything to be completely exclusive. So we couldn't get a release for either television or movie theaters, and that had remained all, you know, up until this day. True, we got it, sort of a special grant, which Apple was very kind enough to give us to show it this one time in this theater in New York City. But we were offered over $1 million to begin with by Columbia Pictures to allow it to be released as a movie at that time. But we couldn't, as I say, we couldn't get that release. We were fortunate enough to get it shown on CBS. We got a release for that once in 1964. That's the only time it's been shown publicly.
So now you'll have control over it again?
Well, it's more complicated than that. The thing is that... John Lennon isn't around. He was a big buddy. He moved into the Dakota, and I at that time and still now I live at the Dakota. So he always wanted to do something to get that film shown and to make more films with us. But as you know, the Beatles broke up, and they got connected with all kinds of legal problems that that made it difficult to do anything.
My guest is Albert Maysles, and a 25-year anniversary retrospective of his films with his late brother David is about to be shown at the Film Forum in New York. We're going to talk more about his movies after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Documentary filmmaker Albert Maysles is my guest. Let's talk about your 1969 movie Gimme Shelter of the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont. This is the concert that ended in the murder of one of the fans. I think it was Hell's Angels who were responsible for the murder. Now, were you filming that as it happened?
Yes. Well, we had four or five camera people there. Most of them got drugged up by being given wine that they didn't know was loaded. And so it was really another cameraman and myself who did most of the work at the Altamont concert. And so for that particular scene, my brother happened to be with the other cameraman, so he's the one that actually filmed it.
What were some of the ethical questions you had to ask yourselves when you got the footage and had to decide how much of it to include in the movie?
Well, actually, we didn't ask any ethical questions.
Really?
Because we felt, we didn't feel a need to, we just, you know, behave as one normally does in a crisis, and if one is ethical, as I think we were, then we did, I think, what was ethical. But there were ethical questions that were raised once we made the film, and one of them was whether to use the material of a killing in a film. And the New York Times review, I remember, was headlined "Making a Murder Pay," as if to say that we were very happy that that we had the material and that we were using it because we wanted to exploit that fact. But on the other hand, had we not included it in the film, I'm sure it would have been equally unethical since or immoral, since it was an important part of what took place. Instead of, I think the alternative probably would have been to have made a film like Woodstock, which attempted to make the Woodstock generation and a very happy, unfettered event. And it turns out that it wasn't quite entirely that, nor were the events of Altamont entirely abysmally disaster nature. So I think that we were fair in representing what had to be shown, and fortunately, we were there at the right time to get the killing as well as a lot of other significant things that happened. I mean, significant enough so that I think that the film probably is, in filmic terms, the clearest representation of that generation for that decade.
Did you ever talk to your brother about what was going through his mind when he realized that there was a murder taking place as he filmed?
Well, in truth, he didn't know, nor did I know.
He just thought it was a commotion.
I was only about 20 feet away, myself, filming Mick Jagger. And neither one of us knew what was going on except that there was a scuffle.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't that ethical question either. Although it's an interesting one, it always comes up in one's mind. Will there be some time in my career as a cameraman where I have to make the choice between stopping a killing or filming it? And I think one is so strongly compelled to tell what's going on as a movie maker that one thinks that somehow or other, if that crisis occurs, that you'll be able somehow or other to do both.
Did you ever have a crisis where there was footage that you really weren't sure you should include?
I can't remember. Well, we've had we've had, there have been delicate situations that we've filmed, which perhaps somebody else making the movie might not have included in the film. For example, we filmed somebody at the moment, a man who was in his 50s, who was a public relations expert, who had just been notified that he'd been fired. And this could be very embarrassing for him to have the film shown. And so as I began to film him, I put the camera down and I turned to him and I said, I'd gotten to know him pretty well by that point. I said, look, we would like to continue filming if it's okay with you. And he paused for a moment and he said, okay. And he continued to do what he was about to do, which was to call up his best friend and explain to him all the details of how he was fired and why he was fired and so forth. And it was exactly the man as he really was. And I think that's, there's more ethics, I think, in presenting what's truthful, whether it's painful truth or pleasant truth, than in obscuring it. I think.
But you always run into the possibility of invading somebody's privacy, because we all have thoughts that are true, but that doesn't mean we want to share them with the public.
Right. Well, I think you have to get that permission, or feel that you have it. If somebody doesn't want to share something with the public, then I would go along with that.
You've funded most of your movies not through grants, which is the typical way that documentaries get funded, but rather through making documentary-style commercials and industrials. How come you never went the grant writing route?
Well, I think that, for one thing, by the time you get a grant, having put all that energy into it, it's such a frustrating effort that you might even lose interest in making the movie, or the key elements of what were to take place, you know, had already taken place, and it's no longer a good film. And then you find yourself committed to an organization or organizations that have a hard time because of the bureaucracy, you know, getting you out of it and slipping you back into another film, which would be more interesting at that time. It's been said so many, many times that that an artist, whether he's a writer or a movie maker, you know, relishes and needs the opportunity to express something that he can't even put into words, except that it's a heartfelt part of his soul that he needs to find expression for. And that sort of stuff that's deep inside you, you can't express unless you were a writer, which I'm not. I can only express it by making a movie, because that's what I am, a movie maker.
I want to play one of the documentary-style commercials that you did, and this one was for ABC News to advertise Peter Jennings on World News Tonight. And it's based on, from what I can tell, it's based on an actual telephone interview that you did with Jennings?
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Okay. Let's listen to it.
There was never much doubt in my mind that what I wanted to be was a news person. I don't know why I work so hard, but I mean, I think it has a great deal to do with trying to live up to the sense that I had at the very beginning.
Good night, guys. Thank you very much.
Which was that if you're going to do this, you know, you really are something of a rare bird. You have a rare opportunity, and you just better not ever goof off on it.
Peter Jennings on ABC's World News Tonight.
And, of course, while we're hearing the audio track in the film, it's showing Peter Jennings in action and doing this interview on the telephone. Mm-hmm. The question that these commercials raise to me is kind of what's the point, in a way, of getting all this honesty from somebody to just package it in something that's supposed to manipulate the viewers anyways to either buy a product or to tune into a program? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of honesty at the service of manipulation.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Well, there's more. I don't know quite how to answer that. I don't. There are commercial subjects and products that we wouldn't film. I mean, in the old days, we would never make a smoking commercial, for example, when that was allowed on television.
Right, right.
Nowadays, and always, we've had many offers to make commercials for politicians that we wouldn't vote for. And we had offers to do the Ford campaign and also the Humphrey campaign. Humphrey we liked a great deal, but it was at a time when we thought he had so committed himself to the Vietnam War. We disagreed with that, and we didn't think that he was the right man for president, so we didn't do that campaign. I don't know. You draw the line wherever you can. If we didn't make commercials and corporate films, and we wouldn't do any that we thought were immoral or unethical. What was I going to say? That without doing those, we'd have to commit ourselves to other sources of money where the strings would be drawn on the ethics of our own films.
Right, this form of funding doesn't affect, there's no one to answer to.
Right. We get our money from sources like the commercials and the corporate films, and that's ours to do with it whatever we want.
So you have no network giving you editorial,
right.
Giving editorial control. You have no granting agency saying these are the guidelines you have to follow, so that you have creative freedom in your movies once you get the money from
total
the
total freedom. It doesn't. It in no way guarantees that you'll make a profit on the film, but it does guarantee that whatever the film is, it's a true expression of 100% of what you believe.
Albert Maysles is my guest. Your brother had been your collaborator in movies for the 25 years that you were making movies,
right.
And he died in January. Has it been difficult to carry on without him?
Well, I want to make clear, too, that almost all of our major films we made in close collaboration with Charles Wehrin, and so that it hasn't been just the two of us.
There's still a team that you're working with.
Right,
right. Well, I'm sorry that your brother wasn't around for this retrospective.
Well, his name is attached to it. as you may know, it's dedicated to his memory.
I congratulate you on this 25th anniversary, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
For talking with us about your work.
Thank you.
My guest has been Albert Maysles, who along with his late brother David pioneered the style of filmmaking known as direct cinema. A retrospective of their work will be shown at the Film Forum in New York City from October 16th to the 29th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.